For KOSU News, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. A new alcohol distribution law is facing a challenge in the state Supreme Court. Senate Bill 608 requires manufacturers of the top 25 brands to offer products to every wholesaler, but opponents say it violates State Question 792, passed in 2016, allowing manufacturers to designate which wholesalers would handle their products. Ryan, why would opponents not want the top brands going to all wholesalers?
Well, I mean, there are a variety of reasons. And first, before we delve into this, alcohol laws and distribution laws in the state of Oklahoma are one of the most complex, convoluted areas of, and so, you know, I feel like I have an understanding of what's happening here, understanding of how everything works and how it used to work. Boy, that's going to take way more than we've got time for on This Week in Oklahoma Politics. But there are a lot of reasons why they want to control which distributors and wholesalers are putting out their product. A lot of it's quality control. You know, they want to be able to, or intellectual property rights. They want to have licensing agreements that can, if you're a manufacturer, you want to be able to control everything. And in some instances, I mean, temperature controls, you know, where it's going, you know, packaging, placement. There are a variety of things that you want to negotiate. And if you're just required to put it out to your top 25 selling brands without any of those negotiations, you lose that. And looking at the pleadings here, I mean, the Oklahoma Constitution was amended with the state question, overwhelming vote of the voter, overwhelming support of the voters back in 2016, and now or 2018, and now we're looking at the state constitution now, Article 28A, up against Senate Bill 608. I mean, they're in direct conflict with one another. I mean, we've seen this in the past where the legislature has tried to come back and amend something that the voters have done at the ballot box. Sometimes they can do that. If a state question amends a statute, they get to come back and amend that. But this is the Constitution. And here, if you look at the language of those two things, they're in conflict, or they seem to be in direct conflict. When that happens, the Constitution wins.
And even the Constitution, that usually the vote, will of the voters, is really what the Supreme Court almost always takes into mind.
Absolutely, and Ryan's right. 66% of the voters approved the state question. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it wasn't a narrow margin. And it really, as you said, I mean, it's about the fact that they view their brand as being their most valuable asset. And if you're the supplier that they believe, I mean, the essence of the state question was that you should have the right to choose whether you deal with one wholesaler or all wholesalers. And so I think all of these issues really, I mean, the court is going to ultimately be the ones to decide this, but it is convoluted. And I think even from a legislative perspective, when you get some of these bills as they move through the process, it becomes very difficult, I think, even for lawmakers to kind of dissect and figure out really what the competing arguments are. So it'll be fascinating to watch and see what the court does.
And this really had problems in this session when one wholesaler was accused of paying, not as a lobbyist, but just simply as a business owner.
Well, and there are a lot of stories over that. And then ultimately came to the point that apparently the individual wasn't a lobbyist principal. And so, everything was on the up and up. But, I mean, there are a lot of politics here. There's a lot of money at stake here. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money at stake whenever we're talking about alcohol and alcohol distribution in the state of Oklahoma. If you look, just some inside baseball on these pleadings here, you have Robert McCampbell and Kent Myers, two of the most prolific lawyers whenever it comes to ballot measures and defending ballot measures or opposing ballot measures, everything from getting signatures to going to a court whenever they are challenged.
Yeah.
They're on the same team here. And so when you've got Robert McCampbell and Kent Myers on the same side of a pleading, I mean, I think that tells you where this is stacking up.
They're
defending the Constitution here. They're challenging this new state law, saying that it violates the will of the people and it violates the Constitution of the state of Oklahoma as it was amended by that ballot measure.
Recent flooding and storms bring national political figures to the Sooner State. On Sunday, Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke visited with Tulsa flood victims. And on Tuesday, Vice President Mike Pence came to Tulsa to promise aid to flood victims and pack some boxes at the Community Food Bank of Eastern Oklahoma. Neva, what did you think of these visitors?
Well, I think it's always good when you have folks come in and see from the national side what's going on, get the firsthand view, understand and recognize that the need for the funds to come and come quickly is paramount. And I think, obviously, from a presidential candidate standpoint, I mean, it's an opportunity not only to be in a state and have the opportunity not only to talk to voters, you know, in this particular instance, but also deal with the activist party side as well, as we saw on Sunday. But the other element to this is that I think it does say that from the Oklahoma perspective, when you see the congressional delegation, when you see the federal side starting to mesh with the governor and all of the administration side in Oklahoma, that we are seeing good, quick results, which hasn't always been the case in some disasters across the country. So I think for Oklahoma, it sets up well, hopefully, to get the kind of relief and support financially and otherwise that we need and that we need quickly.
Yeah, Ryan.
Well, this is all in the backdrop of a huge federal disaster aid package that had been stalled for weeks in Congress.
And finally got passed on Monday.
And so we're hopefully now going to see some of this much-needed money coming into the state of Oklahoma and other states that have been affected by natural disasters. I mean, this was a really strange issue with the federal aid package, because most of the time those things sail through. I mean, you may have a few recalcitrant folks out there saying, you know, we shouldn't rebuild in certain areas, or we shouldn't. But this really became a proxy fight for the border wall. And even Republicans and Republican leadership became frustrated with a segment of the Republicans in Congress for holding this up and saying that this represented the new normal and that it was just simply untenable to think that this was the way that we were going to deal with federal disaster aid moving forward. So all of that was in the context of these two visits. You know, the other part of this that I think is really important is to think that, you know, now, you know, and you heard Beto talking about, you know, whenever he was a congressperson in El Paso, you know, that El Paso was often overlooked in the national conversation. And he didn't want Oklahoma to be overlooked. Right. He's talking about that kind of in this context of a general election. Well, he's not going to get Oklahoma's electoral votes, even if he's the nominee. But really what it speaks to is the fact that every state now is important in that Democratic primary. In a primary field as crowded as this one, every state's important. Every delegate's important. And so, you know, Beto coming to Oklahoma, we're going to, you know, I'm sure that we're going to see many more candidates, especially on the Democratic
side. And
this
is not his first time to
Oklahoma. Yeah, coming to Oklahoma, raising money and trying to get votes and delegates here.
And to that point, it also, when Vice President Pence comes, it shines, the national media is going to follow with him. And so it shines the national light onto Oklahoma and some of the needs of Tulsa and
not,
Eastern Oklahoma.
That's right. And not only was the Vice President and the Second Lady here, but you had the acting Homeland Security Secretary, mm-hmm. you had the acting FEMA administrator. So, I mean, they brought a large contingency of folks to see firsthand what was going on here in Oklahoma, and I think that's good news.
Yeah, and we've seen a lot of national news from Oklahoma, but probably not enough. I mean, I think that, you know, there is some sense that we're overlooked here in the middle of the country. And, you know, when I talk to colleagues outside of Oklahoma, they have some sense that, you know, what we've experienced in the last month has been bad. But I think the enormity of the effect that it's having and that will continue to have for months, if not years to come on Oklahoma's economy and people's lives, you know, that story needs to be told more.
The Cherokee Nation elects a new principal chief. The tribe's former Secretary of State, Chuck Hoskin Jr., won the election on Sunday to succeed Bill John Baker. The election came after a lot of mudslinging and one candidate getting disqualified by the tribal high court. Ryan, this was a pretty heated battle.
Pretty heated battle, but then a decisive victory. I mean, you talk to folks in the Cherokee Nation, election results normally aren't out that fast. And so, you know, I think the word was posted around 1, 2 a.m. in the morning, Sunday morning after the Saturday election. That was a pretty quick declaration of victory because, you know, the margins were just there. I mean, I think he had somewhere around 57% of the vote. So even after this very acrimonious campaign, to have that kind of a decisive victory is incredibly impressive for Chief-elect Hoskin. And he's used that as an opportunity to say he's recognized that it was a hard-fought campaign, that there was a lot of mudslinging going back and forth, that there's, you know, the last-minute drama of the disqualification mm-hmm. of, you know, probably the most formidable challenger to Chief-elect Hoskin.
He still got 14% of the vote.
And he still got 14% of the vote in the absentee because he was on that absentee ballot that was mailed out. That we're talking about walking stick there mm-hmm. is the other candidate. You know, that's where I think, you know, Chief-elect Hoskin has really said he's acknowledged it. It was a tough fought race, but it's a time for everybody to come together now. And he's got that kind of a mandate. And if you look at the council now, he's going to have, you know, probably anywhere from 10 to 12 votes out of a 15-member council after all of the runoffs are said and done and said with at the end of, I think, July, August. That'll be wrapped up, and we'll have a sense of what that council actually looks like. But out of 15 members, and he's going to have 10 to 12, you know, solid allies on that council. So expect big things out of Chief Elect Hoskin, and, you know, Bill John Baker, tremendous job as chief of the Cherokee Nation, and, you know, thanks to his service there.
Neva?
I would agree. I mean, I think when you have a decisive win, 57-58% in a very contentious race, and I think we've seen that in many of these races in recent times, where they have been much more aggressive, much more hard fought, and out of this, when you have the opportunity with a clear mandate, as you say, I mean, to be able to move forward quickly, it will put the focus on this transition. And I think when all is said and done, there is the opportunity to make some fairly significant changes.
Governor Stitt pulls from the private sector for the next leader at the Department of Human Services. Villaggio Senior Living CEO Justin Brown is replacing Ed Lake, who held the job for nearly 7 years. Brown will be the head of the largest state agency, which regulates, among other things, assisted living centers like those owned by Justin Brown. Neva, is there any concern of conflicts of interest here?
I don't think so, and I think that was addressed right up front, and I think pretty well put to rest. There doesn't seem to be any indication of that whatsoever. I think what we have is the governor making a selection, as he pointed out, someone who is a strong organizational leader, a proven problem solver, and also someone who has the passion to really deal with the with this state's largest agency and the delivery of these services that people depend on that are in the Department of Human Services. So I think that it will be a very interesting to watch as a new management team comes in, with a philosophy that I think mirrors what the governor wants in terms of making the technology changes, making the changes to make it much more consumer and customer friendly, as they often describe it, but making these agencies much more responsive to the folks that they're serving throughout the state of Oklahoma. And this is certainly, as the state's largest agency, as you say, with offices in all 77 counties, a $2 billion budget. Right. I mean, it's a big thing to wrap your arms around, so to speak, as a new administrator and head of this agency. And I think it will be something that folks, as they step back and watch, will have a great deal of interest. The Pinnacle Plan, obviously, is a component of this and where all of that sets up. But you've got a 40-year-old, very young, dynamic, proven leader who is taking the helm. And I think it will be very refreshing to watch and see what happens in that agency.
Ryan.
It may be just as important as the decision that was made to replace Ed Lake at DHS is the decisions that haven't been made yet. And, you know, in particular, the Department of Corrections with Joe Albaugh, whether or not he's going to be rehired. And I think maybe even more pressing right now is the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services with Terry White. You know, I think the sense around the insiders there is that Terry White's job is safe at least until the opioid trial is over. You know, she is going to be a key component to the opioid litigation that's taking place down in Cleveland County right now. And if, you know, there's an unwillingness to upset that. But I also think that there's a case to be made that the governor could send a signal in that case by casting a vote of confidence towards Terry White now and saying, you know, I'm going to rehire this person so that, you know, her testimony and her involvement in that trial isn't clouded with any sense of, is she going to be the commissioner moving forward, or, you know, can she be impeached because she's not impeached in the political sense, but impeached on the stand as somebody who doesn't have the confidence of the governor and his staff. And I don't think that that's the case. And so I think sending that signal now could be something that the governor can do to weigh in and say, you know, we have full faith and confidence in Terry White, and, you know, especially moving forward with this opioid litigation and the leadership that she's had on that front.
I think as you look at these positions, the ones that have been filled, the ones that remain unfilled, I think what we see with this governor and what was said even when this appointment was made earlier this week was the fact that the transition team had reached out months ago and said, would you be interested? Would there be any interest at all in taking a look at coming out of the private private sector and taking on this challenge. So I think there are a lot of conversations clearly that appear to be going on across the board. And I think the governor has made it very clear that he's not going to be rushed. He's going to wait until he finds that person that he believes is best for that position in his administration that fits with his mindset and where he wants to see everything move in somewhat of a concerted, unified effort, and particularly from a cabinet perspective as they try to integrate all of these agencies and begin to really have the communication effort much more out front and concerted. So I think that the political dimension and the bureaucracy dimension to these appointments, who's been here how long and will they stay or will they not, I'm not sure he's heavily influenced by that one way or the other, including with the backdrop of the trial even coming into play. So it will be fascinating to see. I think we'll see I would presume that we would see in the next months for sure during the summer that these folks would all be in place so that they have the fall to really be engaged and have an organizational structure beginning to really ramp up and be in a good place as we get to the next legislative session.
This is an interesting one also because I remember when Ed Lake was picked to replace Howard Hendricks because of all the situation going on with DHS, the child deaths and everything. And he was picked by a national search by the commission, the Human Rights Commission in Oklahoma to run this. And now we've got, instead of a group of people doing a national search to find the right person, it's one person picking one person to run the gig. And it's a little bit different.
It's a lot more like a private sector headhunting search for a key figure at a corporation than it is for a government agency. And I think that one of the dynamics that's different in that respect is that if you're Google and you're out trying and you've got headhunters out recruiting people to go into key positions for your organization, boy, you've got a lot of things to offer those people. You got salary, you got perks, you get all sorts of things to recruit people to your company. It's really, especially you think about Joe Albaugh's position at the Department of Corrections.
The
director of the Department of Corrections. What are you offering people in the private sector? And even in this instance with the DHS, they said that, well, I have a 1% interest. And they said, as long as you have a 1% interest, we're going to come back to you. And it really is difficult to recruit people to these positions. You have to have a real sense of public service. And you have to be in a position where you can step away in many instances because it could be a pay cut. I think Terry White and Joe Albaugh, both of them could probably leave public service and walk into the private sector and see their earning potential increase. They're in those jobs because they're public servants. And if you're being recruited to these jobs and you say yes, you better have a sense of public service.
Right. And well, I think that is the key. I think it is public service. And I think that is all, the other element to this is I think that when you have a businessman perspective in the governor's chair, you have someone who knows they're coming in for a period of time, going to do the work that they are going to try very hard to get done successfully, and then they're going back into the private sector. And I think you have people in some of these positions that are being brought in that look at this as not just I'm now going to become a public servant and I'm now going to become an agency head and be involved in this indefinitely. Definitely, but rather for a season and time when they can come in and really make some hopeful seismic changes. And I think that's it clearly is the point of view that they're coming in with.
Oklahoma City Democratic Representative Shane Stone says he's not seeking re-election. Stone says after getting his master's in public policy, he plans to remain involved in politics, but in a less public manner. He's stepping down after 6 years in office, which seems awfully familiar, former State Representative Ryan Kiesel.
Hey, six was enough. It was, thanks to Representative Stone for his service to the people of the south side of Oklahoma City. He's in terms of filling that seat, it'll probably be a Democrat that's reelected there. The numbers are really strong.
Two to one.
Yeah. And, I think that we'll probably start to hear some names in the next week as people begin to try to, get some early advantage in fundraising and probably people out knocking doors this summer to get ready for that Democratic primary because it'll look like the Democratic presidential primary, right? It could be very crowded. But, you know, 6 years is a long time at the Capitol, and I think that you learn a lot in 6 years. When you're ready to go, you should just follow your gut on that. I followed my gut when I was ready to go. I know a lot of my colleagues that, you know, after 6 years, they said, boy, I kind of feel like I want to do this too. But they stuck around for another two or another four, or in some cases, another six. And almost all of them have later told me that they wish that they would have left whenever they did, because they left, you know, I left on an up note. And, you know, I chose my own time to go. You know, I knew that if I'd stuck around, I was just going to, you know, continue to, you know, do the same things. And I was ready for something new and exciting. And I suspect that that's probably the case with Representative Stone.
And even 2 years ago, about two years ago, was when the dominoes started falling of all the people who said, yeah, I'm not going to seek re-election. Is this the first in impossible dominoes of people saying, I'm done and let someone else take the mantle?
I think given the trend, I think that we can expect that it will be the first of several. And now the sequence of how early these begin to roll out, I mean, right. I think by the fall and certainly by early next year, well before filing, I mean, there's always, whichever party we're talking about, there's always the point of view that no one wants to be kind of left in the lurch with these last minute, you know, filing week, and all of a sudden an incumbent's not running and whichever party is in question is scrambling, or both parties are scrambling to try to find people in that district to run. That's never a good scenario. So I think there is this expectation as people may begin to think about calling it quits earlier rather than going for another re-election campaign, that will happen soon enough that we'll, as Ryan's right, I think we'll expect this floodgate now to start in any district where if you've got 2-1 Democrat district, it's a district that I think we're going to see a lot of activity on the Democrat side, but it will be an open seat at that point. So the Republicans clearly will take a look at it and see if they can recruit a good candidate to be in the mix in that race. So it's kind of the setup now as we begin to think about next year. It's not just about a presidential year, but it's about a legislative year and a lot of campaigns that we'll be talking about.
And Representative Stone, you know, really young. I mean, is in his mid
20s.
Yeah, mid 20s. I mean, so yeah, he's I retired at the ripe old age of 30. So he's retiring in his mid 20s from the legislature, and he's got a tremendous amount of experience.
Well,
out
let's
there.
Remember, he can come back at some.
That's
point.
That's right. You got 6 years of eligibility.
He's not precluded from being able to come back in some future.
And of course,
time.
If laws change, there was a law this year to increase that amount on term. Senators and representatives, how much time they could spend. So hey, it might be even longer.
Yeah.
So, I'm guessing that also it gives him a chance, since he's still going to be there for at least another year and a half because he's filling out his term, that kind of an announcement to fellow employers, hey, I'm going to be out in the job market.
Well, that's just it. I mean, if you look at the age range of a lot of folks at the Capitol, you know, for the longest time, it was something that people did at the end of their career or that they did and they already had an established career. And so if they left the legislature, they went back to something. You know, I was in law school when I got elected. And, you know, so being able to build a career and build a professional life outside of the Capitol, you know, so that whenever you leave, you've got the ability to, you know, you make some money and pay your mortgage. And those are important things. And when you're in your mid-20s, you know, this is an opportunity for Representative Stone to walk out and build a career. He's got a new degree, and you know, his education is completed. He can get out and establish himself in a way that he probably hasn't had a chance to do up until this point.
It's already a pretty strong resume.
Yeah.
Right, and a lot of these lawmakers, I think, going in with this expectation that this is a part-time job,
yeah.
And that they're going to have much more flexibility in terms of being able to maintain their career path, their job, whatever else they're doing. And they quickly, oftentimes I hear this, that they never realize how much time. It's not just the legislative session. It's year long in terms of what they need to be involved in and back in their district, as well as committee work and other things at the Capitol. So while their pay is a salary that many can't certainly live on exclusively, I mean, depending, it is something that I think that we're seeing more and more of, and particularly with these ones that come in young. You're right. I mean, they have a career ahead of them. So, you know, at what point do we take the best earning years and have that exclusively public service, or do we do a combination? And I think that's what we're seeing with Representative Stone.
And Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.